Counselor, how precious to me are thy thoughts, O God. Psalms. The 150 prayers that make up the Psalter, or Book of Psalms, constitute a kind of recapitulation of much, though decidedly not everything, that precedes them in the Bible. Many of the events and issues raised in the first 26 books of the Tanakh, the 5 books of the Pentateuch, the 6 of the Deuteronomistic history, and the 15 of the prophets, recur in the Psalms by allusion. Many of the Psalms are explicitly attributed to King David, and a few of them are further specified to a given moment in David's career. Others, by their content, give other clues to when they were first spoken, or more likely sung. Such diversity in content and occasion make it difficult to specify what the Psalms collectively say about God, much less to make that something a step forward in the biography of God. But 3 factors greatly mitigate that difficulty. First, the Psalms are all spoken in the present tense. Though the moment in which a given psalm was written may in fact lie in the past, the fact that the psalm has been preserved and collected constitutes an implicit claim that its thought or sentiment is still valid. When a psalm is very specifically located in the past, the implication is that that past moment and the sentiment then expressed are worth recalling and in some way still valid. Thus, Psalm 59 is one that David spoke when Saul sent men to watch his house in order to put him to death. But the sentiment in its opening verses transfers easily to other situations. Save me from my enemies, O my God, secure me against my assailants. Save me from evildoers, deliver me from murderers. The second mitigating factor for a synthetic reading of the Psalms is the fact that a great many of them are altogether without specification as to time or place. The third mitigating factor is that though the Psalms may have been written at very different historical moments, we are reading them all at the same literary moment. We may say of the Psalms something analogous to what we said of the prophets when we compared them to the correspondence of a great general read after the war was over. His character, as the letters reveal it, will have been his character even during the war. But because we only discover after the war what the letters say about his character, it is as if, for us, his character changes after the war. Rather than correspondence with the great, the Psalms often read like interviews with the obscure. Anonymous foot soldiers and taxpayers, who testify to the character of their leader most convincingly, not by what they say about him, but by what they say to him. Notably, they all do seem to have spoken to him on one occasion or another, great or small, public or private. What is the moment in which these interviews are conducted? It is the moment characterized at the start of this chapter by our reading of the 3 post-exilic prophets. Israel changed its religion and abandoned God. Then God, enforcing the terms of his covenant with Israel, punished Israel and sent her into exile. But he had promised that he would take pity on her and bring her back in triumph, a triumph that would lead the whole world to pay homage to the 2 of them, God and Israel together. Now Israel, in the person of the exiled Judeans, has returned to her capital city and resumed a national life. But that national life has proven parlous and dreary. We should imagine the psalms spoken or sung in the temple that the returned exiles built in Jerusalem. They were slow to build it, so pressing were their practical needs, and after it was built, it struck many of them as decidedly unimpressive. As we come upon the congregation praying to him in just this building, that surprises us. They are living at peace. The Jews, in fact, did live more or less peacefully as a province of the Persian Empire for 2 centuries before Alexander the Great, sweeping in from the west, ushered in another period of extreme violence in their history. Let us imagine them about halfway through the Persian period. Malachi, the last prophet, has died a century ago. Alexander, undreamt of, is still a century in the future. Quite clearly, God and Israel have come to terms with each other. But what are the terms? What should strike anyone who reads the Psalter, after reading straight through the prophets, is that whereas the prophets speak of wicked Israel, the psalmists speak of the wicked in Israel. The prophets did speak some of the time about a faithful remnant, which they contrasted with the apostate majority. But from the Exodus to the Babylonian captivity, the more frequent contrast was between Israel and the other nations of the world. Individual differences were all but eliminated in this religiously collectivized worldview. If King Manasseh led Judah into idolatry and child sacrifice, no effort was made to find or deal separately with those of his subjects who may not have joined him in his sin. Guilt and innocence were shared. This seems clearly to have changed. One of the most touching of the Psalms is the briefest, Psalm 131. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor my look haughty. I do not aspire to great things or to what is beyond me. But I have taught myself to be contented like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child am I in my mind. O Israel, wait for the Lord now and forever. In the imposed peace of the Persian Empire, Israel has ceased to be even a minor actor on the international scene. Centuries have passed since Israel's God last went to war. His victories over Pharaoh, over the 31 Canaanite kings who fell to Joshua, over the Philistines whom David routed, are a distant memory. What loom larger for a nation thus confined within its own borders are personal victories and defeats, joys and sorrows, and, most important, it seems, personal innocence and guilt. Enemies are referred to in perhaps one-third of all the Psalms, and the attack that they have launched against the psalmist, the attack that prompts his prayer, is far more often than not an accusation of wrongdoing. It is possible, if not indeed all but certain, that many of these psalms of individual entreaty to God make reference to an ancient courtroom, and that the vindication prayed for is legal relief. Even if this is not true, or is only metaphorically true in some cases, the effect of the preoccupation is to make God seem less an invincible warrior and more a powerful magistrate whose steadfast love for the defendant will protect the defendant from the plaintiff and the plaintiff's powerful and unscrupulous allies. It is noteworthy that the psalmists, though they be as humble as the author of the psalm just quoted, never apologize for addressing God directly and never fear to do so. They may doubt their own innocence. They may worry about his inattention or severity. But they do not fear to approach him in the first place, as the Israelites rightly feared to approach the all but out of control volcanic deity who gave the law on Mount Sinai. Even the guilty may come to him if, as in the following famous example, they arrive pleading for mercy. Out of the depths I call you, O Lord. O Lord, listen to my cry. Let your ears be attentive to my plea for mercy. If you keep account of sins, O Lord, Lord, who will survive? Yours is the power to forgive, so that you may be held in awe. I look to the Lord. I look to him. I await his word. I am more eager for the Lord than watchman for the morning, watchman for the morning. O Israel, wait for the Lord, for with the Lord is steadfast love and great power to redeem. It is he who will redeem Israel from all their iniquities. The Psalter contains a number of psalms that read as war songs. One is Psalm 144. Blessed is the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for battle, my fingers for warfare, my faithful one, my fortress, my haven and my deliverer, my shield, in whom I take shelter, who makes peoples subject to me. And the signal victories of the past are ceremoniously recalled again and again. Their martial spirit is familiar, even by this point classic. A different spirit, however, shapes the group of 30 or 40 psalms that makes no reference to war or to any national enemy, past or present. A good many, as noted, refer to personal enemies, but others simply call on God in distress for relief, or even in the absence of distress for favor and support. And the universal assumption, which we noted first in 2 Isaiah, is that God is a friend intimately acquainted with the supplicant. In the Psalms, any Jew may pray to God for deliverance, as Jacob prayed to the personal God of his father Abraham, or as David prayed to his invincible ally. In Psalm 56, identified as of David when the Philistines seized him in Gath, David imagines in a vivid metaphor that God will capture and save the young captives every tear. You keep count of my wanderings. Put my tears into your flask, into your record. Comparable claims in less dramatic settings are everywhere in the Psalter. One of the most eloquent comes at the opening of Psalm 139. O Lord, you have examined me and know me. When I sit down or stand up, you know it. You discern my thoughts from afar. You observe my walking and reclining, and are familiar with all my ways. There is not a word on my tongue but that you, O Lord, know it well. You hedge me before and behind. You lay your hand upon me. It is beyond my knowledge. It is a mystery. I cannot fathom it. The subtle but pervasive change that separates this passage from comparable passages about the unknowability of the Lord in 2 Isaiah is that here the focus is on the individual human knower, not on Israel as a whole, and that, quite clearly, the psalmist regards knowledge of the Lord as, in and of itself, a prize beyond compare. Later in Psalm 139, the psalmist exclaims, "How weighty your thoughts seem to me, O God! How great their number! I count them. They exceed the grains of sand. I end, but am still with you." The RSV translates, "How precious to me are thy thoughts, O God." The Hebrew word can bear either meaning. The echo in the next line is, of course, of the Lord's promise of innumerable offspring to Abraham. Now it is God's thoughts rather than Israel's offspring that are beyond number. But how has the psalmist come to know the thoughts of God? At various points earlier, we have noted that God seems to have not only no private life, but also no private thoughts. He speaks no long, thoughtful soliloquies, and in fact says nothing that does not have mankind, or, more often, Israel as direct referent. The words God speaks in creating the world are a soliloquy of a sort, as are the words he speaks when announcing the world's watery destruction. But otherwise, all his words, including all his legislation, are spoken to mankind. This is true even about the Torah, which is not imposed upon Israel at Sinai as a way to open to the nation the weighty or precious thoughts of its God, but as a way to establish a covenant. And the covenant itself is imposed not as its own reward, but as a means to rewards that for both sides were extrinsic. Israel would receive a land and the supernatural fertility promised to Abraham. God, tacitly, would accomplish the restriction of his initial gift of fertility to this one nation alone. All that conceded, the law remains a uniquely extended externalization of the mind of God. However merely instrumental it may have been when first revealed, it is susceptible of a second kind of appreciation as what the psalmist calls the precious thoughts of God. And this appreciation, the main theme of a number of psalms, sometimes called the Torah Psalms, is the background theme of literally dozens of others. In effect, whenever the psalmist claims righteousness as his ideal, or celebrates righteousness in God, whenever he mentions steadfast love, or speaks the rhythmic and lapidary Hebrew phrase, Ki Leolam Hasdo, for his steadfast love is forever, he is reclaiming the covenant and extolling the law. Each of the psalms after the first two carries a heading indicating, variously, its author, the occasion on which it was spoken, the melody to which it was to be sung, the instrumental accompaniment it was to have, or any of a variety of other now scarcely decipherable matters. The first two psalms, lacking any such heading, are almost certainly to be taken as themselves headings for the collection. And Psalm 1 establishes the new centrality of the law as meditation and delight, the vehicle by which the individual Jew establishes a personal relationship with God. Happy is the man who has not followed the counsel of the wicked, or taken the path of sinners, or joined the company of the insolent. Rather, the teaching of the Lord is his delight, and he studies that teaching day and night. He is like a tree planted beside streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, whose foliage never fades, and whatever it produces thrives. Not so the wicked. Rather, they are like chaff that wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not survive judgment, nor will sinners, in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord cherishes the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked is doomed. When the psalmist says studies, we should almost certainly understand private and public recitation rather than silent contemplation. Yet studies is not a mistaken translation. This was, and in some synagogues still is, a distinct form of study, an intimate, sensuous communing with the text through its sound, though not to the exclusion, because a total exclusion would be impossible even if sought, of its meaning. Why does the psalmist not delight in the prophecy as well as in the teaching of the Lord? Why does he not study day and night Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea? These too are the weighty thoughts of God, but they are passed over in total silence in the Psalter. The very words prophet, prophets, and prophecy occur, among them, perhaps 5 times in the entire 150 psalm collection. The reason why prophecy is passed over in silence is almost surely also the reason why it died out, and why the prophet Zechariah himself looked forward to its dying out, namely that what the prophets prophesied had in very large measure not come true. The statutes and ordinances of the law as such, not being predictions, could not be invalidated by mere history as the prophecies could be and had been. There were, of course, promises and threats to Moses in the Pentateuch, but the Mosaic promises and the threats, both the blessings and the curses, had come true, the one at the beginning, the other at the end of the pre-exilic period. It was the prophesied great restoration, the promises made through Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, that had not come to pass. The silence of the Psalms about the prophets extends even to those matters in which, as regards the law, the prophets may seem to have anticipated the Psalms. Thus, circumcision, whether of the penis or of the heart, is never mentioned in the Psalms. When God spoke to Jeremiah about circumcision of the heart, he took up again an image that he had used when speaking through Moses, and one that might have seemed to commend itself to the psalmists. Through Jeremiah, he said, "To the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, circumcise yourselves to the Lord. Remove the foreskin of your hearts, O men of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my wrath go forth like fire and burn with none to quench it, because of the evil of your doings." The injunction given through Moses in the book of Deuteronomy was Jeremiah's model. "Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no longer stubborn." In both cases, the image is intended to suggest sincerity, the mind being scarred inwardly as a sign of fidelity to the covenant, just as the penis is scarred outwardly. And in both cases, as well, the reason for fidelity is inseparable from the consequences of infidelity. The Lord will reward the one and punish the other. This is true even when, through Moses, the Lord tells Israel to think about his words. Therefore impress these my words upon your very heart. Bind them as a sign on your hand, and let them serve as a symbol on your forehead, and teach them to your children, reciting them when you stay at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you get up, and inscribe them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, to the end that you and your children may endure, in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to assign to them, as long as there is a heaven over the earth. And yet by this insistence on inward obedience, a path was laid for an inwardness that would be of delight as well as of obedience. This is the delight in the law of the Lord that opens the book of Psalms. If the spirit of the Psalter is a spirit looking away from battle and grand predictions and toward private life and the law, one would not know it from Psalm 2, the second of the two Psalms that together are an extended superscription for the collection. This psalm envisions nothing less than a world empire for the Lord and the anointed King of Israel, the Lord's Messiah. What is foreseen is notably not the conversion of the nations, as spoken of in the prophets, but outright military domination of the sort that was promised to the tribes of Israel when they conquered Canaan. Why do nations assemble and peoples plot vain things? Kings of the earth take their stand, and regents intrigue together against the Lord and against his anointed. Let us break the cords of their yoke, shake off their ropes from us. He who is enthroned in heaven laughs, the Lord mocks at them. Then he speaks to them in anger, terrifying them in his rage. But I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. Let me tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, You are my son, I have fathered you this day. Ask it of me, and I will make the nations your domain, your estate the limits of the earth. You can smash them with an iron mace, shatter them like potter's ware. Were it not for its placement, this psalm might be regarded, in the manner indicated earlier, as one carried forward from the nation's past, more a celebration of past glory than a program for current action. Because of its placement, it should be regarded as stating the ideal relationship between Israel and the other nations. In that regard, the two psalms state a kind of double ideal, Israel at home and Israel abroad. To judge from the rest of the Psalter, however, Psalm 1 states an ideal that is being pursued, Psalm 2 a dream that has not been abandoned. It is not that there are no other moments in which the psalmist speaks to the Lord as to a warrior. The second most famous psalm, after Psalm 23, is Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon there we sat and wept, as we thought of Zion. There on the poplars we hung up our lyres, for our captors asked us there for songs, our tormentors for amusement. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. But this plaintive beginning soon yields to a thirst for revenge. Fair Babylon, you predator, a blessing on him who repays you in kind, what you have inflicted on us. A blessing on him who seizes your babies and dashes them against the rocks. Nothing that once appears in God's personality ever quite disappears. Anything that disappears for a time may always stage a return. In principle, God will never not be a destroyer, and never not be a warrior. And yet, on balance, the dominant mood of the Psalter is one of gentle trust in God, ardent or urgent in times of strife, in the personal laments and entreaties that so crowd the opening pages of the Psalter, grateful and lyrical in times of peace, as in the best-known psalm in the Psalter, and perhaps the best-known poem in Western literature, after the Lord's Prayer. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for Thou art with me. Thy rod and Thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The difference in mood between this psalm and A Blessing on Him Who Seizes Your Babies and Dashes Them Against the Rocks is breathtaking. And in the long run, any discussion of the character of the Lord God must simply admit that both moods are native to Him. Neither psalmist is mistaken about Him. And it should be noted that even Psalm 23, so often printed in illustrated versions for children, includes the prayer that the Lord will make it possible for the psalmist to flaunt his good fortune before his enemies. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. The God of the Psalms is never too tender for vindication. And yet, to return to the central assertion, what is new in the Psalter, what seems to represent a distinct and pervasive change of emphasis in it, is the shift of attention from national to personal and familial welfare, and from aggressive public and political themes to the quiet study of the law. The militaristic Psalm 2 is, in point of fact, not the prelude to a series of psalms praying for the destruction of individual nations, matching the oracles in which the prophets predicted such destruction, nation by nation. And the context, probably the historical context and certainly the literary context, in which Psalm 2 is spoken, is the virtual erasure of prophecy by David's last heir, the failed Messiah Zerubbabel. The king of Israel was at one point a king with peoples subject to him, bound in the bonds that Psalm 2:1 alludes to. In Psalm 2, is the psalmist thinking of God as an imperialist in his own time? We should probably say rather that he is remembering the imperialist of the past. Dreams can arise from memories, and subsequent, grandiose, ultimately suicidal adventures in secular messianism may well have fed on certain of the psalms. On the other hand, memories may also remain memories. Staying at the literary level and noting the ambivalence and implicit conflict, one may also reasonably concede a greater force to that in the anthology, which is not just vigorous but also new. In the Book of Psalms, what is vigorous and also new is the romance of law. Sometimes by direct statement, more often by implication, the psalmist opposes the great man to the good man. And it is the good man with whom he and his God are in love. Come, my sons, listen to me. I will teach you what it is to fear the Lord. Who is the man who is eager for life, who desires years of good fortune? Guard your tongue from evil, your lips from deceitful speech. Shun evil and do good. Seek amity and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, His ears attentive to their cry. The face of the Lord is set against evildoers, to erase their names from the earth. They cry out, and the Lord hears, and saves them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted. Those crushed in spirit He delivers. The opposition is not between Israel and the nations, but between the righteous and the evildoers, either within Israel or simply without regard to nationality. Law, longevity, and stability are linked motifs in this vision. In Psalm 1, the righteous man is like a tree planted near water, growing, maturing, bearing fruit over many years, while the wicked is chaff carried by the wind. Torah, the religious teaching of Israel, and wisdom, the common secular heritage of the ancient Near East, are near a fusion in this vision, a fusion that, as we shall see, grows more complete in Proverbs. And the rewards of Torah/wisdom are all on an emphatically human scale. No psalmist ever promises that the righteous will have offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven, or the territory of a long list of neighboring peoples. The rewards are rather those of a reasonably prosperous family life. Thus do the romance of the law and the romance of the family become a single romance. Happy are all who fear the Lord, who follow His ways. You shall enjoy the fruit of your labors. You shall be happy, and you shall prosper. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine within your house, your sons like olive saplings around your table. So shall the man who fears the Lord be blessed. May the Lord bless you from Zion. May you share the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life, and live to see your children's children. May all be well with Israel. In the presence of the truly great, the good always seems small. In the presence of the truly good, the great always seem vain. The competing visions of the Jewish people, as we have them in the Psalms, have held the imagination of so many other peoples over so many centuries because they contain such an extraordinary range of human possibilities. Imagine a meeting between two Jews. The first is the man addressed by the psalmist here, the man at the head of his table, or, perhaps better, one of the olive shoots around his table, a boy of, say, 18 years. The second is that other young Jew of whom Isaiah dreamed. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." Whatever the logical or theological contradiction between the two visions, there is a night and day emotional difference between them. But how irresistible each is on its own terms! Which boy do you choose? And the deeper biographical question, of course, which boy does God choose? In Psalms, on balance, God chooses the olive shoot over the branch of Jesse, the symbol of the Davidic messianic line. The holy king is dead, long live the pious commoner. "Better the little that the righteous man has than the great abundance of the wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord is the support of the righteous. I have been young and am now old, but I have never seen a righteous man abandoned, or his children seeking bread. He is always generous and lends, and his children are held blessed." If the question God asks through the prophets, and essentially of himself, is, "Can we begin again?" the question the Jews ask in the Psalms, after the failure of prophecy, is, "Can we again begin again?" They answer their question in the affirmative by circling back not, as God himself did when speaking through the prophets, to cosmic and historic victories of yore, but to the law as a good in itself, indeed as God himself. When the Lord gave the law at Sinai, he himself did not become lawful by giving it. Power, not lawfulness, was his defining feature. But now, to speak plainly, the Lord has been defeated. He has only the memory of victory. And by a paradoxical move, the Jews are taking the law imposed on them and imposing it on him by their very delight in it, by their very celebration of it as his precious thoughts. The idea of morality as an end rather than a means, as a good in itself rather than an instrument to achieve some other good, is an idea even at this point still in the making. A happy family life is, after all, no mean reward. And by, as it were, retrojecting God's projection of himself, his law, back into him by personalizing it and inserting their acceptance of it into a personal relationship with him. The Jews who collected the Psalms, dividing them into five books, mirroring the five books of Torah, moved that idea an enormous step toward accomplishment. God has been continually surprised by what ensued from his initial creation of an image of himself. And the change in him, the taming, we might almost call it, that occurs in Psalms is scarcely the least of these surprises. We all know the trick of forcing a performer off stage by applause. The Psalms do nothing so crude as that, but their praise certainly goes disproportionately to Tzedek and Hesed, God's righteousness and his steadfast love, rather than to his prowess in battle or his bounty. But if God is surprised, so are the Jews, for they owe this new relationship with God to the Gentiles via the accommodation made for the Gentiles by the prophets. Tacitly, this much of prophecy does find its way into the Psalms. As monotheism came to final formulation in 2 Isaiah, it became apparent that the Gentiles would have to be accommodated in some way in Israel's covenant with the Lord. But in the end, the place made for them became a place occupied as well by the Jews. The Noachian covenant, until the prophets, the only formal covenant in the Tanakh that did not distinguish Israelites from Gentiles, did not in fact require worship of anyone. By its meager terms, human beings, plant-eaters in the Garden of Eden, were permitted to kill and eat animals, so long as they did not eat them alive. This is the meaning of the command at Genesis 9:4, "You must not eat flesh with its life-blood in it," but forbidden to kill their own kind. Nothing else was required of them. God, for his part, agreed to refrain from destroying the whole world again. He promised nothing more. To a much later generation of anthropologists, the Noachic covenant might be fascinating as a dim memory of the transition of the human species from pure gatherers to hunter-gatherers, and from hunters eating the kill immediately, as simple predators, to hunters eating the corpse of the kill after a delay at least long enough for it to bleed to death. But abstention from devouring a live kill, or murdering a fellow human, amounts to exceedingly little as the acknowledgement of God, much less as the expression of a relationship with God. And in speaking to the prophets of his new relationship with the Gentiles, the Lord never mentions Noah. The covenant within which the Lord intends, or once intended, to accommodate the Gentiles is the Mosaic covenant. To cite again two passages cited earlier, "The foreigners who joined themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, every one who keeps the Sabbath, and does not profane it, and holds fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples." But this development, the Lord assures Israel, will only enrich his original covenant partner. "Aliens shall stand and feed your flocks. Foreigners shall be your plowmen and vine-dressers. But you shall be called the priests of the Lord. Men shall speak of you as the ministers of our God. You shall eat the wealth of the nations, and in their riches you shall glory." In other words, the Gentiles will be included in the obligations of the covenant, and this is clearly regarded as a boon and a privilege for them. But only Israel will be materially enriched by the covenant. In the event, of course, the Gentiles did not volunteer to accept the covenant or come to make burnt offerings and sacrifices in Jerusalem. But it may well have been through a consideration of the religious situation of the Gentiles that the idea of Torah as boon and delight quite apart from the blessings and curses of Deuteronomy 28, first came to the fore. And after the failure of prophecy, which is to say the failure of God to restore Israel to autonomy, and even hegemony, as he had said he would, the Jews were faced with the choice of Torah as a good in itself, or no Torah at all. They chose the former, and celebrated their choice in the Psalms. To say this is to present, as coolly as if it were a move in chess, a change that was surely attended by inner as well as outer agony. When, under Hezekiah, Jerusalem succeeded in turning back the army of the Assyrian Sennacherib, Judah seems to have made the tragically false inference that its fortress capital was impregnable. As the truth began to dawn on them, and the fall of Jerusalem began to seem not just possible, but inevitable, a ghastly panic took hold. The Jerusalem Bible translates Jeremiah 30:5-7, from the eve of disaster, as follows. We have heard a cry of panic, of terror, not of peace. Now ask and see. Can a man bear children? Then why do I see each man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor? Why has every face grown pale? Disaster. This is the great day, no other like it. A time of distress for Jacob, though he will be saved from it. It seemed, in other words, almost contrary to nature itself, that Jerusalem should fall. And though this was a disaster that would also overtake the guilty, it was nonetheless distressing that, short of that point, the guilty seemed to prosper. Jeremiah again, this time in the Jewish Publication Society translation. You will win, O Lord, if I make claim against you. Yet I shall present charges against you. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are the workers of treachery at ease? You have planted them, and they have taken root. They spread. They even bear fruit. You are present in their mouths, but far from their thoughts. Yet you, Lord, have noted and observed me. You have tested my heart and found it with you. Drive them out like sheep to the slaughter. Prepare them for the day of slaying. The defeat itself was such as to all but drive the nation mad. Almost equally mind-rending was the scandal that the innocent, those who knew in their hearts that they had indeed kept the covenant, were punished along with the guilty. This view receives extended, explicit, and in context, shocking formulation in Psalm 44, which rehearses God's past victories as many another psalm does, and humbly concedes that it was not by their sword that they took the land, their arm did not give them victory, but your right hand, your arm, and your goodwill, for you favored them. But to this bright past the psalmist contrasts the dark present, in which you sell your people for no fortune, you set no high price on them, and then proceeds to the core of the indictment. All this has come upon us, yet we have not forgotten you, or been false to your covenant. Our hearts have not gone astray, nor have our feet swerved from your path, though you cast us, crushed, to where the sea monster is, and covered us over with deepest darkness. If we forgot the name of our God and spread forth our hands to a foreign God, God would surely search it out, for he knows the secrets of the heart. It is for your sake that we are slain all day long, that we are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. Rouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O Lord? Awaken, do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face, ignoring our affliction and distress? The language, rouse yourself, and so on, echoes 2 Isaiah. But that prophet, when promising that the Lord would rouse himself and awake, conceded that the punishment inflicted on Israel had been deserved, even if ultimately it had gone too far. No such concession is made here. Some historical critics believe that Psalm 44 must have been written in response to some later defeat. And so it may have been. but by its placement it can only refer backward to the defeat by Babylon, and to the condition of the restored nation as a byword and a laughingstock among its neighbors. The mention of the sea monster recalls the flood and alludes to the deepest, most unspeakable fear of the demonic persona still latent in the god of precious thoughts. Guarantor. In the markets she raises her voice. Proverbs. The new centrality of the law, as a defining reality in the life of God, creates a new vulnerability in him. A vulnerability not, as before, to rival gods, but to rival laws or law equivalents. This is the drama hidden in one of the least read books in the Tanakh, the Book of Proverbs. God's law, which in the Psalms is regarded as his most important and most abiding self-expression, yields much of its space in Proverbs to a larger, anonymous, and impersonal tradition of secular wisdom. And this alternative to the law is preached by a completely unexpected alternative to the prophets, namely Lady Wisdom, a mysteriously allegorical combination of goddess, prophetess, and angel. The subtle emergence of Lady Wisdom as God's rival, as well as his handmaiden or consort, is accompanied by a paradoxical reversal of the role that the Psalms assign to God. In the Psalms, God is the guarantor of justice in a world of karma without samsara, a world, that is, in which the good are rewarded and the evil punished within their own lifetimes, or at most in the persons of their children or grandchildren. Not quite so in Proverbs, where God appears for the first time as the mysterious being to whom reference must be made, and from whom recourse must be had when just the opposite occurs. That is, when the good are seen to be punished and the wicked rewarded. God continues to be honored as the creator, through wisdom, of a world which enjoys in general an immanent moral order. A world, in other words, in which reward for the good and punishment for the wicked is on the whole a natural and therefore automatic outcome. God is not expected to ensure the functioning of this moral order by intervening ad hoc with rewards and punishments. These come about as the intrinsic result of mankind's cultivation, or otherwise of human wisdom, a pursuit sometimes characterized as devotion to Lady Wisdom. God created the world through her, Proverbs says, and the world's normal and normally benign functioning is in her custody. God takes, or is presumed to have taken, a direct hand only in counterintuitive, unpredicted, unwelcome limit cases. In brief, when things go right, as Proverbs expects they will, God is honored as the creator of a world in which things go right, while when things go wrong, God is acknowledged as the source as well as the explanation of exceptions to the rule. God is marginal as a picture frame is marginal. He is not often in the picture, but the picture requires him. This quasi-negative but necessary framing function for God is the meaning of a proverb, "The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord," that is repeated almost as a mantra 3 times in Proverbs, at least once in the Psalms, and elsewhere in these books with minor variations. Its meaning in a secular formulation might be, "The first thing a man of understanding must understand is that there is much that he will never understand." Mankind will ever strive to bring life under control, and Proverbs commends that effort. But a man who does not recognize how much inevitably will escape his control is doomed to frustration and despair. Common sense is, so to speak, never more than a clearing in the forest, and it is best to be prepared for this at the outset. Proverbs 16 gives this view, central as it is to the marriage of Torah and wisdom, an extended gloss. A man may arrange his thoughts, but what he says depends on the Lord. All the ways of a man seem right to him, but the Lord probes motives. and trust your affairs to the Lord, and your plans will succeed. The Lord made everything for a purpose, even the wicked for an evil day. There is no easy transposition of this last line into a secular key, since, now as then, it is at just this point that secular wisdom reaches its limit. But we must recognize, all the same, that Proverbs 16:4 is an answer of a new and most untraditional kind to the entreaty in literally scores of psalms that the Lord put the petitioner's wicked enemies in their place, give them what they deserve, and give the righteous petitioner his own due. No, the Lord is here imagined to respond, I have my purpose for them, and, by clear implication, you must endure them. This is both a drastic restriction and a drastic revision of God's role as protagonist of the Bible. In a sense, mankind now becomes the protagonist, and God the antagonist. The happier outcomes are assigned to human effort, and God is assigned ultimate personal responsibility for those times when the opposition, human and circumstantial, proves insuperable. He is made in a remarkable way the personification of all that, and as such he becomes, if not the explanation of it, then at least a name for it. Instead of saying, in other words, there is no figuring it out, Proverbs says, there is no figuring him out. Secular, contemporary reformulations tend to make impersonal what Proverbs makes personal. Thus, for example, into each life some rain must fall, or such uglier, more recent versions as life's a bitch and then you die, or shit happens. But these actually fall short as reformulations of Proverbs 16:4, because they are in no way confessions that life exceeds the speaker's understanding. On the contrary, they are smug in their confidence that all relevant evidence has been examined, and this is the bitter result. In order to avoid claiming omniscience, they would have to admit mystery in some way, and thereby cease to be as terminally secular as they wish to be. The verse, "The Lord made everything for a purpose, even the wicked for an evil day," may have been most comforting to those who wrote and preserved it because of its assumption that the Lord was good. But the same verse has a liberating potential even if nothing is assumed other than that the Lord is mysterious, or at a further reduction that life itself is a mystery and not just a mess. Better a humble but at least potentially merciful uncertainty, in short, than a proud and inevitably masochistic certainty. This is perhaps Pascal's wager 2 millennia before Pascal. And yet it is scarcely a triumphant moment for God himself. Now that the world is up and running, God is to be summoned only when things are at their worst, so he is all but forced to be always and only his own worst self. "Comfort, comfort my people," is a line he no longer gets much chance to speak. In most troubles, mankind comforts itself or has itself to blame. There is no scope at all for God's newfound tenderness. Rather than a comforting person, he here seems to be a semi-comforting assumption at best, and the old destroyer at worst. Reading Proverbs after reading Psalms is rather like leaving the steamy murmur of a crowded church, where hidden agonies and immoderate hopes have all been on sometimes painful display, and stepping into the busy briskness of the marketplace outside the church door. Close enough, to be sure, but still outside. The stakes out here in the daylight may be much lower, the only eloquence a rough and ready tartness of repartee. Yet there is something bracing about the change. Everyone still believes in God, indeed casually refers to him in every other sentence. But everyone also seems to have other business than his in hand, and to be relying on Mother Wit, as we might well put it, rather than on Father or Grandfather God. For the Lord God is indeed beginning to seem an elderly relative, still nominally the head of the house, but no longer very active as a manager. In Proverbs' Marriage of Torah and Wisdom, Torah, or at least the Lord whom Torah honors as its author, deepens wisdom. But wisdom also broadens and brightens Torah by discussing such matters as character formation and prudence, parts of human moral experience about which Torah is generally silent. The most surprising feature of this new synthesis, however, is that in it prophecy, about which Psalms maintains such a pained silence, is revived, after a fashion, as Lady Wisdom preaching on a street corner. But what kind of prophecy does she preach? Dispensing with impassioned indictments, intoxicated visions, all mention of foreign countries, and any prediction of apocalyptic doom, she has the mannerisms of a prophetess, but a message that scarcely goes beyond, "If you make a fool of yourself, don't say I didn't warn you." Her revival of prophecy is, in a way, its burial. Wisdom cries aloud in the streets, raises her voice in the squares. At the head of the busy streets, she calls. At the entrance of the gates, in the city, she speaks out. "How long will you simple ones love simplicity? You scoffers be eager to scoff. You dullards hate knowledge. You are indifferent to my rebuke. I will now speak my mind to you, and let you know my thoughts. Since you refused me when I called, and paid no heed when I extended my hand, you spurned all my advice, and would not hear my rebuke. I will laugh at your calamity, and mock when terror comes upon you, when terror comes like a disaster, and calamity arrives like a whirlwind, when trouble and distress come upon you. Then they shall call me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me, but not find me, because they hated knowledge, and did not choose fear of the Lord. They refused my advice, and disdained all my rebukes. They shall eat the fruit of their ways, and have their fill of their own counsels. The tranquility of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of dullards will destroy them. But he who listens to me will dwell in safety, untroubled by the terror of misfortune." In prophecy, as we have hitherto seen it, the events mentioned in the lines, "The tranquility of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of dullards will destroy them," would have been presented as punishment rather than, as here, mere comeuppance. Here the only punishment is self-inflicted. It is simply the predictable, built-in consequence of foolish behavior. Is it surprising that this clearest, largest eruption of the feminine into the relationship of mankind and God should turn out to speak with the voice of common sense? That will depend, obviously, on what you understand by the feminine, and also on what you expect of a mother or a wife. Historical criticism has paid little attention to the possibility that wisdom may be either mankind's mother or God's wife, but this is largely because historical criticism has generally taken her to be a personification of the wisdom of the male god, and therefore, notwithstanding the feminine grammatical endings, ultimately male herself. She has been seen as a figure of speech loosely akin to the word of the Lord in the endlessly repeated figure of speech, "Then the word of the Lord came to." In fact, however, her identity is a good bit more complicated than that. For Lady Wisdom speaks not just for God, but also in her own name about God, and about her relationship with Him. The word goddess probably does misrepresent her. But even taking her as allegorical rather than mythological, she should almost certainly be seen as the personification of human wisdom in the newly autonomous sense of which we were just speaking, rather than as the personification of unfathomable divine wisdom. As such, she may well be spoken of metaphorically both as God's partner, even God's wife, mankind cooperating with God, and as mankind's mother, mankind caring for its own. And as both wife and mother, wisdom wakes the echoes of Asherah. Wisdom speaks of her double relationship with God and mankind at Proverbs 8:22-9:6. The Lord created me at the beginning of His course, as the first of His works of old. In the distant past I was fashioned, at the beginning, at the origin of earth. There was still no deep when I was brought forth, no springs rich in water. Before the foundations of the mountains were sunk, before the hills I was born. He had not yet made earth and fields, or the world's first clumps of clay. I was there when He set the heavens into place, when He fixed the horizon upon the deep, when He made the heavens above firm, and the fountains of the deep gushed forth, when He assigned the sea its limits, so that its waters never transgress His command. When He fixed the foundations of the earth, I was with Him as a confidant, a source of delight every day, rejoicing before Him at all times, rejoicing in His inhabited world, finding delight with mankind. Now, sons, listen to me. Happy are they who keep My ways. Heed discipline and become wise. Do not spurn it. Happy is the man who listens to Me, coming early to My gates each day, waiting outside My doors. For he who finds Me finds life, and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who misses Me destroys himself. All who hate Me love death. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has prepared the feast, mixed the wine, and also set the table. She has sent out her maids to announce on the heights of the town, "Let the simple enter here." To those devoid of sense, she says, "Come, eat My food and drink the wine that I have mixed. Give up simpleness and live. Walk in the way of understanding." At the point in this speech where wisdom says to mankind, "Now, sons, listen to Me," the burden of proof might seem to shift to those who would deny that she is in any way a mother, not just because of the use of the word banim, sons or children, but also because of the clearly parental manner. But in what sense, if any, can the speaker be a wife? True, the fact that God has created her by no means rules out this possibility. As His wife in any ancient Near Eastern context, she would not need to be His uncreated equal. Nothing would prevent Him from creating her as His consort after, or, as she insists, before creating mankind. No, the difficulty in naming wisdom as God's consort appears to lie rather in the fact that, despite His delight in her, she seems as much assistant as companion. She is a builder, a butcher, a baker, a vintner, as well as a teacher and a confidant. But does all this taken together make her a wife? Obviously, one must first ask, what is a wife? In the entire Bible, there is only one description of the wife, and it comes, as it happens, in just this book, at Proverbs 31:10-31, which opens, "What a rare find is a capable wife! Her worth is far beyond that of rubies. Her husband puts his confidence in her, and lacks no good thing. She is good to him, never bad, all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax, and sets her hand to them with a will. She is like a merchant fleet bringing her food from afar. She rises while it is still night and supplies provisions for her household, the daily fare of her maids. She sets her mind on an estate and acquires it. She plants a vineyard by her own labors. She girds herself with strength and performs her tasks with vigor." In the ancient Near East, wives were both a form and a source of wealth for their husbands. Like Lady Wisdom, the good wife in this description combines delight with good management. By the same token, then, if we find this combination in Lady Wisdom, we may infer that she is to be considered, at least metaphorically, as God's wife, She and God do not have even an analogous genital relationship. There is not the slightest hint of that in the text. But she is genuinely female in the same characterological way that he has always been genuinely male, and their partnership to that extent is a connubium. And if, in addition, she represents mankind as a whole, where is the difficulty? In the prophets, God has repeatedly and ardently called himself Israel's husband. Here he would be mankind's husband, in a relationship in which mankind is an unusually vigorous and self-reliant wife. It need come as no surprise that as the Tanakh shifts its attention to practical skills, its attention to women should grow. Before, as well as after the exile, several of Israel's larger neighbors enjoyed a noticeably higher level of material development than Israel did, as well as a deeper integration into world commerce. The skilled workmen who built David's palace and Solomon's temple were brought in from Phoenicia. Certainly before and probably after the exile, foreign wives were a major channel by which non-Israelite material culture entered Israelite life. Despite the severe strictures placed on intermarriage in Torah, Moses, David, and most notoriously Solomon, not to speak of Abraham, Judah, and Joseph, all are reported to have had foreign wives. Solomon's many wives are blamed in 1 Kings for the introduction of foreign religion into Israel. But doubtless they also brought foreign crafts, languages, music, food, and so on. In short, all the foreign forms of industry and wealth, and doubtless taught what they brought with them to their Israelite sisters. Thus was the good wife like the merchant fleet, and thus over time the sense may well have grown in Israel that women, especially foreign women, were the repository of much of the material expertise of the world. If this is the case, then we should not assume that every time Proverbs begins one of its anonymous speeches, "My son," a father is to be imagined as the speaker. The New Revised Standard Version's inclusive language, substituting "my child" for "my son" throughout, is at odds with the content of a good many speeches that seem explicitly aimed at young men. But if it is rarely easy to imagine a young woman as the hearer, it is often quite easy to imagine an older woman as the speaker. Not that Proverbs is a feminist text. By contemporary standards, it is serenely sexist, inveighing repeatedly, for example, against the loose woman, with nary a word about the loose man. But often a closer look exposes an interesting ambiguity, especially where sexual morality is concerned. Who is speaking in Proverbs 7? A long speech against the loose woman that is barely begun before it turns to an eyewitness account of seduction as seen through a latticed window. A man might, of course, watch a seduction through a latticed window, but this is just the vantage from which, in a Near Eastern society accustomed to female enclosure, a respectable woman would be most likely to witness such a scene. It is easy to imagine, as a result, that my son is being warned against the loose woman by his mother. Daringly, the speaker imagines a woman of her own social class, a woman married to a man of some means, betraying her husband in his absence by seducing a young stranger. Who but a mother could imagine so well what a woman of a certain age might say to an innocent like her boy? From the window of my house, through my lattice I looked out and saw among the simple, noticed among the youths, a lad devoid of sense. He was crossing the street near her corner, walking toward her house in the dusk of evening, in the dark hours of night. A woman comes toward him, dressed like a harlot, with set purpose. She is bustling and restive. She is never at home. Now in the street, now in the square, she lurks at every corner. She lays hold of him and kisses him. Brazenly she says to him, "I had to make a sacrifice of well-being. Today I fulfilled my vows. Therefore I have come out to you, seeking you, and have found you. I have decked my couch with covers of dyed Egyptian linen. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Let us drink our fill of love till morning. Let us delight in amorous embrace. For the man of the house is away. He is off on a distant journey. He took his bag of money with him and will return only at mid-month. Feminine authorship seems plausible for this passage on another ground besides the lattice window. Though obviously full of resentment and censure, the writer is quite without the kind of visceral revulsion that the prophets so often seem to feel at the very thought of a woman in a state of sexual arousal. The writer sees the loose woman as, with all her faults, a fellow human being, and not, as a Jeremiah would see her, as a beast in heat. A wild ass, used to wilderness in her heat sniffing the wind, who can restrain her lust? None who seek her need weary themselves. In her month they will find her. Metaphorical prostitution and literal prostitution, male as well as female, are inseparable for the prophets, and with reason. When Jeremiah begins this indictment of Israel for Baal worship by saying, "On every high hill and under every green tree you have sprawled and played the whore," he is referring to the sacralized sexual relations that were a part of the fertility cult of Baal and Asherah. But what is it that appalls him more, apostasy or fornication? For Proverbs, a whore at her most brazen is not to be compared to an unclean animal in heat. Proverbs may have occasional sharp words about sexual misconduct, but much of the time its writers simply show a lively interest in the subject. Whom do we imagine, what kind of man or woman, juxtaposing the following two bon mots? Three things are too wonderful for me. Four I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. This is the way of an adulteress. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, "I have done no wrong." This is, as the saying goes, splitting the arrow. A bullseye followed by another bullseye, eloquence about the wonder of sexual love, followed by superb bluntness about what it can sometimes become. There is no reason whatsoever why my son might not have seen both arrows shot by his mother. So might he also have heard from her the wry and pungent lesson offered at 6:6-11. Lazy bones, go to the ant, study its ways and learn. Without leaders, officers, or rulers, it lays up its stores during the summer. Gathers in its food at the harvest. How long will you lie there, lazy bones? When will you wake from your sleep? A bit more sleep, a bit more slumber, a bit more hugging yourself in bed, and poverty will come calling upon you, and want, like a man with a shield. Surely it is beyond argument that, time out of mind, Jewish parents, like all parents, have found themselves urging industry upon their children. And yet, until Proverbs, such sentiments do not receive even the most modest formal accommodation in Israelite, Judean, or Jewish religious experience. No book of the Tanakh before Proverbs contains anything comparable to "go to the ant." The Decalogue contains no commandment, "Thou shalt work." And on innumerable occasions God has stressed in speaking to his people that it was on his power, rather than on their own, that they should rely. We have referred more than once to what is perhaps the most striking example of this, namely Deuteronomy 6:10-12. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to assign to you, great and flourishing cities that you did not build, houses full of all good things that you did not fill, hewn cisterns that you did not hew, vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant, and you eat your fill, take heed that you do not forget the Lord who freed you from the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. Moses is not licensing laziness per se, but his aggressive de-emphasis of the importance of human effort in Israelite achievement began a tradition that continues unbroken to the point we have now reached. Not, we may be sure, in the unwritten life of the nation, but very definitely in its written literature. Sigmund Freud defined happiness, famously, as Leben und Arbeiten, love and work. Lady Wisdom, as we have just seen, is frank about sex and frankly interested in sex, a hard worker and an advocate of hard work. She is not Asherah Redux, but she does take Asherah's ancient symbol as her own. She, Wisdom, is a tree of life to those who grasp her, and whoever holds on to her is happy. We may recall that the tree of life was the tree whose fruit the Lord God feared Adam and Eve would take also and eat and live forever. This tree was the second for which the Lord God was concerned. The first, the object of his direct prohibition, was the one called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. After Adam and Eve ate from that tree, the Lord God said, "Now the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil." However, for Adam and Eve themselves, that first tree seems to have been not very unlike the spreading green tree of Asherah, for when they tasted its fruit they knew desire for the first time. Then they perceived that they were naked. When Lady Wisdom insists on her earliness, when she places herself in the primal scene of creation, close to God in a relationship of delight, and when we find her represented by the tree of life, a tree standing not just for sexual fertility, but for all the practical skills that support life, we hear many echoes of Asherah. But it would be mistaken to say that Wisdom now feminizes God's character by being absorbed into it. She remains distinct from him by representing, instead, collective humanity, God's image and God's antagonist. God's full command to his image at Genesis 1:28 was, "Be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, and rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on earth." If the first half of that command was a command to beget and bear children, the second half was a command to use wisdom, the created human strengths of mind and body, to provide all that children would require. God's relationship with Adam and Eve, though the word covenant is never used of it, was implicitly a covenant that, minimally, he would not prevent what he had commanded. But then, at the flood, he did prevent it, and after the flood his covenant with Abraham compromised it. Lady Wisdom personifies mankind, by a roundabout path indeed, obeying God's initial command and reclaiming God's initial promise. But was God, even supposing his intentions to be the purest and stablest, ever able to keep his promise? This is the question that Proverbs leaves unanswered by assigning to God the role it does. And this is just the question that is taken up with a vengeance in the book of Job. Can God be trusted?